And you have this windshield. Yes, sir. Let's start this. Hold on one moment, and the Honorable Mr. David Neal will be the lead of the roll this morning. So we're going to ask if you could just hold this for one moment, and he'll be with you shortly. And I do need to make one phone call. Unless I get the phone call, then I'm going to turn it over to the Honorable Mr. Neal. Okay, so if you can just hold on.
That's all right.
Okay. Honorable Mr. Johnson, I forgot to ask you a phone call. We didn't get our notes. Okay. According to what I have, it's this number right here.
Linda Newman? Norman? Nyman.
Yes, it is.
Hi, this is the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. I understand you wanted to participate in the parole hearing for Kelly Hamilton?
Yes, I do.
Okay, if you would just stand on, the Honorable David Neal will be conducting the hearing. I'm going to catch you in, okay?
Okay.
Ms. Nyman, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, Mr. Hamilton, are you on the line?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, well, now we will turn it over. The next voice you hear will be that of the Honorable Mr. David Neal, as he will lead the hearing for us this morning.
Good morning, sir. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. Sometimes the speaker phones give us some problems, so if at any time you can't hear what I'm saying, or if you don't understand what I'm saying, please let me know so we can make sure we can correct that, okay?
All righty. Thank you.
Okay, so you're praying for the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency this morning in reference to a parole hearing, or which would be for letter parole, or after discharge. Would you state your complete name and ABC number for the record, sir?
Kelly K. Hamilton, 046036.
Thank you, sir. All right, so I have released information and wrote some things about your court hearings and your time in prison and even back to the original offense. And as I go through, I'll make sure that I've got it right. If you hear something that is wrong, please let me know. And once we get there, we have an opportunity to tell us more about you and what you've been doing for the last few months of your last hearing. And then we'll go from there, okay?
All right.
All right. So you are currently 66 years old, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, you're serving a life sentence for first degree murder, which the sentence began June 24, 1982. You became parole eligible on June 24, 2007, and you certified for this hearing for rental home arrest after discharge on March 16, 2018. You've appeared before the board 21 times, and you've been not denied each time. Is that all correct, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Seems that you have a very limited discipline history since you've been incarcerated with your last ticket way back in 2003. That's pretty commendable.
Thanks, sir.
Then it looks like you have, when we first look at the age record, it doesn't show a whole lot there, but then there's a large stack of certificates and verifications, so it looks like you've done quite a bit of programming.
Yes, sir.
And a lot of that outside of the prison system, like junior college, a lot of inmates don't take advantage of those kind of opportunities. It's just if it's not offered on the yard by DOC, they don't believe it. But You've done a lot and kept yourself busy warning, which is very commendable. And it seems that for the lease plan, if there's a few little issues in it, but the Reborn Systems has sent several letters saying they'll accept you when you're released. But their last letter was from August of last year, which I believe was prepped for your last hearing. But they have sent several letters along the way, so it seems as though once you've got a lease payment, you've got a place to go.
Also, sir, I've been accepted to another halfway house. I didn't want to just leave it with that one. This letter was, I just got it on 5/23. The reason why it's not in there is part of the program. It's transitional living.
One thing I noticed on the Reborn Systems, and I know TLC is basically the same on their financial aspects, and that's that the Reborn wants to, and I don't know if they take all the money initially, but they want you to have $100 up front before they actually physically accept you there, because they run into problems with people that they don't have the first couple of months worth of finances in their bank account. They run in there and come in there and run up a bill and they have discharge because they're not paying the rent. So they pretty much require that you would have, their letters say about $100. I'm not sure paying that dollars at TLC, but that's also the budget corrections.
Well, this is not TLC. This is transitional living. It's separate from TLC.
If it's a pay for, if you have to pay.
Right. I have the money to pay for those.
Okay. Right. Well, that's and TLC. We have to see that too.
Right.
It's a little tough to send somebody out homeless that's been incarcerated as long as you've been here.
Right, I have funds for all that.
Okay, and I noticed you have several offerings that you've submitted in the last few years, where there's different information that comes in there, and some of it is repeated, and some of it isn't in the current application, but there's one place in reference to you want to move to North Carolina.
Well, eventually, once the parole officer sees that I fit within, the guidelines, and I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, and, he feels comfortable with it and all out here, I would like to move closer to my kids and my grandkids. So.
Okay. Well, it's called Interstate Compact, and it's
right.
You apply for voting, you have to agree to it,
exactly.
And all that stuff, and it takes some time, and everybody, but that's where the majority of your family is in.
Yes, sir, in North Carolina. Okay. That's where all my family is at.
Okay, all right. So, it seems that you have your prior criminal history before this offense was North Carolina, is all I found in there, and started in 1975, which looked like it was a motor vehicle crash and somebody died. Assaulting police, probation violation, issuing bad checks, had probation revoked, you had two different prison escape charges. One of those I know was you were in a facility outside of the main prison and you were left to go get some medical treatment and you didn't return. It looks like the total shows that you have three felony convictions with three prison terms, two paroles, two escapes, and a probation. So, does that sound about right for your history?
That sounds about right. Young, stupid. Didn't understand the consequences and wasn't willing to accept responsibility like I should have been back then, but I thought behind me.
Okay, I'm going to give a brief summary or synopsis of the legal reference that Andy wrote there in this sentence, and it was, looks like back in March of 1982, you were involved in hitchhiking, and the victim had given you a ride from San Diego along the way. You pulled a knife on the victim, tied him up, put him in the back of the van, and you treated the ride for probably determined the amount of time. And you stopped and pulled the victim out of the van, stabbed him to death, and left his body in the last year of the building. Later, you traded some of the property for the cash at a pawn shop, and so once you were caught and had the investigation with them, and then you were offered a plea agreement, I guess, to get the death penalty off the table, and pled to a life sentence with 25 years of minimum time served before you could apply for parole. The way that is written is a little confusing because it says if you're sentenced to prison for your natural life, but then it goes on to say you can get parole after 25 years. Usually when they go back to life and you're running, you're stuck. But you took a plea and now you're serving your time, and so I want to turn this over to you to tell us a little bit about what was going on. You already told us basically what was going on in your life before this offense occurred, but tell us a little bit about the hitchhiking trip and then what you've done to better yourself, and primarily what's been going on for the last 6 to 12 months in prison. Okay, sir?
Sir, Randy? Well, the story is pretty much there is the truth. My brother and I left North Carolina. I was on probation in North Carolina. My brother was, they were looking to try to him and my back there on some drug charges. He was doing a lot of selling dope and stuff back there back then. And he was left North, was leaving North Carolina, coming out west to get away from all that. He's my younger brother. I've always been extremely protective of him, and that's the way I was raised. It's just you know, the way a lot of us in the South look at things. The older live, always look after the younger. And we left. He was leaving. I figured I needed to go with him. Of course, I was, like I said, I was young, stupid. I wasn't really all that young. I was 29, 30 years old, but still pretty stupid. Didn't have the best raising when I was coming up. Didn't have the best examples to follow. My father started out bootlegging. He was in a lot of trouble. His brothers, my uncles were always in trouble and stuff. So I guess I just kind of followed suit there. We left North Carolina and went out to San Diego. We stopped in Texas for a while. Worked a couple of weeks there. Get a little bit more money, and then went on out to San Diego. We get to San Diego, it's terrible out there. It's raining all the time, it's kind of cool, just miserable. We couldn't get a job nowhere, and things just went from bad to worse. I mean, it was just miserable. So we decided to go back to North Carolina. So we left and was coming back to North Carolina, and right outside San Diego, we stopped at 7-Eleven, kind of a quick market there to get something to eat. And that's where my brother talked to Mr. Pritchie. And Mr. Pritchie had stopped there with a van while we were sitting outside at a picnic table. And my brother had gotten to talking to him and stuff, found out that he was going east. And like I said before, my brother done most of the talking. I didn't talk to him that much and all, so I didn't really know exactly how far he was going and all that. But anyway, he agreed to give us a ride, so we bought a couple of cases of beer. and we had some weed, and also we had been smoking weed, and my brother and I had taken some, well, my brother had been taking some phenobarbital tablets. So we started driving, and Mr. Fritchie was driving. I was sitting in the passenger seat, and my brother was sitting on the engine compartment behind, or between, kind of between the two seats. And we drove quite a while, just talking, driving, listening to some music, smoking some weed, drinking the beer, and all that. And I didn't know really what my brother was planning. I don't think he really knew what he was planning. It just kind of happened. But we get down next to El Centro, and Mr. Pritchie pulls over to let us out. When he pulled over side of the road to let us out, my brother pulled a knife on him. And I was, like I said, I was sitting in the passenger seat, and I didn't know really what was going on at that point. And my brother forced him in the back and tied his hands and was sitting there. And I was the only one with driver's license. So I started driving. My brother told me to drive the van and head on towards home down the interstate. So that's what we were doing. My brother and Mr. Fritz sat there talking a lot. I didn't really hear a lot of what they were saying. I was paying attention to driving, and they still had the music on. Every once in a while, I'd hear a little something. They were talking, this, that, and the other. My brother was kind of carrying on a conversation with him. And we get down next to Gila Bend. At that time, I didn't know exactly where we were at. We were still on the interstate. I didn't know what state we were in or anything. I assumed we were in Arizona, and we were. My brother said we'd pull over and rest for a little bit, and he had to use the restroom. So we pulled over, and about 30 feet or 40 feet off the highway down this little road that it looked like it might have been a road going up onto a farm or something, but there wasn't no houses around. And my brother, when I started the van, my brother opened the door, and him and Mr. Pritchie got out. I get out of the driver's side, and I hear the commotion, and as I'm coming around the front of the van, I hear a commotion. When I come around the van, my brother's stabbing Mr. Pritchie, and he was kind of holding him a little bit close to him. I didn't know what was happening. Mr. Pritchie's a pretty good-sized guy. I'm 5'8" and a half. I weighed 145 pounds. My brother, about the same size, a little bit bigger than I am. I didn't know what was going on, but he scared me. That's when I stabbed him. I stabbed him in the back and in the side, because I thought he was, I don't know, really, honestly, I don't know what I was thinking. I was drunk anyway, high, but that's when I got involved in it. And that's where we ended up taking Mr. Pritchie's life, and then we jumped back in the van and just kept driving. We drove on back to North Carolina. When we got back to North Carolina, I went ahead and trumped myself in. My brother and a friend of his took stuff out of the van and pawned it for money to support their trip back to Texas. They took a friend of his car and the money they got out of the stuff that they had pawned and went back to Texas. U.S. Marshals busted him in Texas. I was in the prison there in North Carolina finishing out my sentence when the detectives came and talked to me. And they'd been three or four different stories. I told two or three different stories. My brother told two or three different stories on how all that happened and everything. But it's never been the true story until here lately. A couple of years ago, I started at the parole board here. That's when I went ahead and told what was really happening. I was trying to protect my brother, but it was not right to protect him like that, because it's just made things worse. He got out about 11 years ago. He's living somewhere back in North Carolina. I haven't heard from him in a while. I don't know what's going on with him. I'm still setting up in here. and you know, I'm doing everything I can. This is my 21st parole board hearing. I turned down one, waived one parole board hearing because I was trying to get an attorney, but I didn't have the money for all that. This would be my 23rd one if I hadn't waived that one. I work every day. I work all day long. I go to programs and stuff when they allow me to go. The programs and stuff they have now, there's this priority ranking, and they're not letting me get into the programs. So what I do is I just work all the time and stay disciplinary free, mind my own business, do everything I can around here. When these youngsters and stuff ask me, and I try to help school them with their GEDs on the run and programming, and help them with their studies with DNA and AA and all. But the program is priority ranking thing out list. They won't let me back in these programs because I've taken so many of them. And I just one parole board to the next, and hoping that I'll eventually, maybe I can get out, and once I'm out, do something to make amends for some of what I've done back when I should have known better and didn't. I've learned a lot since I've been in here. I'm an adult. Like I said, I'm 66 years old. I probably don't have that many years left. I've already lived longer than most of all the rest of my family. I'm the oldest surviving member of my bloodline. And I haven't seen any of my family or my kids. They don't have the money to come out here. And, you know, I don't want to put that kind of burden on them anyway, because it's so hard for them back there. They don't have, a lot of them don't have the education or to have the kind of jobs that would pay them the money to come out here and things of that nature. And that's pretty much it.
Pardon, sir. So, since your last hearing, do they have allowed you to do any programming or do anything different like that? Just continue on with your work? And
yes, sir. I work all full days. I work 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. And the programming and so forth they have, like I said, are priority ranking programs. And they usually don't let these lifers stuff get in these programs because they're trying to get all these kids and stuff with these 2-year sentences and 3-year sentences and 6-month sentences and stuff, get them in the programs because they're fixing to get back out. A lifer, they don't have a date when a lifer's going to get out, so they don't even put us on the priority ranking list. And I would also like to say that, you know, I have all the remorse in the world for what I had done. I wish to God I could have changed it. I wish somebody had beat me with a 2-4 back before I ever left North Carolina. I had empathy for the family. I wish there was something I could do, get out and do to help the family of my victim. I am extremely sorry, and that's, you know, I've tried to show remorse, and other than the stupid things I was saying and doing, trying to protect the involvement of my brother in this, and I accept my responsibility. I should know what he was doing. He didn't tell me what he was doing, but I got involved. I'm just as guilty as he is, you know, on all of this, and I wish I'd have told the truth of it back then. Maybe he would be in a better situation than what he's in out there. Maybe he would have learned something. I don't know what he's into out there right now, but it's probably not a situation that would have been better for him if I had told the truth to begin with, because he wouldn't, maybe he'd have got more help. He can't read nor write. He has diabetes, his liver's shot. I know that for a fact. My other brothers told me that. And, you know, I've made a lot of mistakes. And I'm trying to learn from those mistakes. I'm trying to do the best I can to make amends. But I've reached the limit that to in here to what I can do to help make amends and then show the remorse and the empathy I have for the victim's family.
Okay. I'm going to see if myself Borland was having any questions at this time. Mr. Johnson?
So I just really had, I know you said that both of you, can you hear me, sir?
Just barely. I can't really understand.
Is that all right? Is that better? Mr. Hamilton? Mr. Hamilton?
I can't hear you.
Is that better?
No, sir, I still can't hear you.
I don't know what else. I guess. Is that any better?
That's a little bit better.
Okay. Is that on the monitors? I know that you said you and you wanted to tell various accounts of how this incident occurred back in the day. But in the pre-sentence report, when you were after you were arrested, that was done. In that report, you said that your brother, Willie Hamilton, was not involved in the commission of the crime. Do you recall that?
Yes, sir. I said that because I was trying to take the blame for the whole thing, and I know it was a mistake now, but back then, I didn't really give it any thought. Like I said, the way I was raised, the older always looks after the younger, and I was just taking the blame for that. That's the reason why there's three or four different stories on the record about it, and you know, this truth never really came out until here recently about all of this. I mean, I was always pretty much taking the blame up until, you know, the board kept telling me that they knew there was something else going on. They didn't believe the stories before and all that. I honestly wasn't telling the whole truth and stuff because I figured that eventually, regardless of what I said, the board would let me out, and now with this being my 23rd hearing, I know that's not the case. I know that I may not ever get out. So there's no good in me sitting here telling stories that's not the truth, because like I said, I may not never get out. You may decide not to ever let me out. You may decide not to ever give me the chance to get out of here and try to make some type of amends somewhere down the road for the wrongs that I've done and all. So me sitting here trying to tell stories and stuff that's not true anymore, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't matter anymore. So that's why I'm trying to tell you what could happen now so you have some type of insight into it. Whether you give me parole or not, it's going to be based upon how your interpretation of what I say goes. But it's no sense in me telling those false stories like I was doing it again, trying to cover him. He's a grown person. I'm a grown man. And like I said, I'm 66 years old. You may not ever give me parole anyway. So the truth is the truth, and that's what I'm trying to do.
All right, thank you, sir.
Question? Mr. Knowles?
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Mr. Hamilton, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
I just have a follow-up question, and I think just something I'm still not understanding. Regardless of who did the stabbing on this case, your brother was your co-defendant. So, straighten me out here again. Did your brother do any prison time?
Yes, sir. He was a juvenile. He got a plea agreement for 21 and 16 and a half. He done all. He had release dates. He done it under the 65% code, the old code. He got out 11 years ago. He got out in January. I know December. I think it was December 2006 or January 2007.
I guess what I'm asking is, isn't it just sort of convenient for you to say that your brother did it now because he's free?
Well, that's what I'm trying to tell you is you know, it's kind of, I told the other story for so daggone long, and it was a lie, and, you know, I don't stab in the victim, too. I'm just, like I said, I'm just as guilty as my brother is. But I'm not telling you the story just because he's out. You know, it doesn't make any difference, really, that he's out.
I covered for him,
and like I said, the parole boards in the past have all wanted me to tell the truth. I'm trying to do that. I'm trying to do as show that what I've learned in here makes me a better person. I am a grown adult man now. I'm trying to accept responsibility for what I've done. Whether I get out or whether I don't, it still doesn't change the fact that I am nowhere near the same person I was when I helped him kill Mr. Pritchie and take Mr. Pritchie's life for something that should not have been done. And the only reason that it was done was so that my brother could take his van and his property. And that was selfish, it was immature, and it was just everything in the world was wrong with that. And I'm trying to make amends for that. Whether I get out of, you know, parole or not, at least I can know that I've told the truth now, and that's what it is.
Okay, Mr. Hamilton, just a quick follow-up, and this is just the part that I don't understand. You know, there's a lot of crime out there.
Right.
A lot of drug abuse.
Right.
Drinking. I don't understand the violence associated with this case. Like, not that there is a good answer, but I just don't understand the violence potential in you and your brother.
I can't explain that other than when I came around the front of the van, my brother, him, Mr. Pritchard, and my brother were already. I don't know whether something happened that I didn't see or whatnot, but I do know I seen when I come around the front of the van, my brother already was stabbing him at that point. I got scared. Mr. Pritchard was 6'2", weighed 210 pounds. I'm 5'8". I've never been involved in any types of extreme violence like that. I've been involved in fights and stuff like that, but nothing to this extreme. So I don't know what led up to it. All I know at that moment, what flashed through my mind was I need to help my brother. That's when I started stabbing Mr. Pritchard. I stabbed him in the side, I stabbed him in the back, I think I stabbed him a couple, two or three times. I don't even, it happened so fast, everything was so crazy. I don't know how many times I stabbed. I honestly do not. And it's been 37 years now, 36 years, almost 37. It's certain things I can't remember. There's no excuse for what we've done. There's no excuse for the violence. There was no excuse for taking Mr. Pritchard's life. That's all I can say about that. I just don't understand it either.
Well, thank you for your response. How old were you when this happened again?
I was about 29, almost, well, I might have been 30. It was in 82, yeah, I was 30 years old. I just turned 30 in January that year. Okay. But I still wasn't an adult. I'd been doing dope and been doing drugs since I was 16, and I was stupid. I didn't take responsibility for nothing back then. I thought everything was supposed to be what I wanted and when I wanted it and however I had to get it. And I didn't have good role models like I've had since I've been in here. I didn't have the programming I've had since I've been in here. And I was stupid. I was still basically a juvenile in an adult body. I didn't even treat my family the way I should be treated as family. I had a wife and kids, but that don't mean I was an adult, which I wasn't. I was immature and stupid.
Well, thank you, sir. No further questions.
Thank you. And thank you so much, Mr. Neal, Honorable Mr. Neal, Ms. Campbell. I believe, according to age, this must be the seventh time that I have had the opportunity to speak with you or to see you. You refer to your family back in North Carolina. You tend to leave them out of the picture at this time. But I'm wondering, how do you stay in contact with them? And the reason I ask that question, just looking through the recent files, you've had three or four letters that were sent just recently to this board. So you're in regular contact with your family back in North Carolina, sir? Am I correct?
Yes, sir. We write each other all the time, me and my other brother, Danny, and my son, and my daughter, two of my daughters. And I've got them on my phone. Up his phone with Danny. I call Danny all the time. Sometimes my kids are moving around. They all the time losing their phones, this, that, else. And, you know, I stay in touch with them through Danny. And I believe Danny, in fact, I just talked to him the other night on the phone. He told me that he had just wrote a letter to the board and sent it to you. In regard to...
We did receive his letter. We received two or three more from North Carolina.
My son was supposed to have wrote you a letter. Two of my stepbrothers were Rusty and Todd Lumsford. They're my half-brothers. They said that they wrote you letters.
So, do you recall, about how old were your kids when this incident took place, sir? About how old were your kids back in... North Carolina.
The three kids, they were 9, 10. The oldest one was, I think the oldest one was 11. And then 10, 11, and 8, I believe it was.
What happened to your wife, sir?
She passed away in 2000. She had a heart attack and passed away in 2000. We were married right up to the time she passed away.
Okay. Now, in terms of your saying now that you're telling the truth, these may not be your words, but now you're telling the truth. You went all of those years with, you know, just making up stories to protect your brother. Aside from your...
Well, it wasn't just to protect my brother. I was telling those lying and stuff because I started out lying, and I thought I had to keep lying. I thought if I changed and started trying to tell you the truth, it wasn't the way you believe it anyway, and it wouldn't make no difference.
Well, see, I guess my question is, why are you telling the truth now, sir? Any particular reason why you're telling the truth at this point?
All this programming in here, and at my age, I'm 66 years old, and through all these programs, the Victims Impact Program, the CIR programs, all these parity programs, and all these other programs I've taken, you know, it's taught me to be an adult, to own up to what I did, take responsibility for my life, my actions, and what I do, and my choices in life. And whether I get out or not, I've got to do that to have any kind of peace of mind. I mean, I was always trying to second guess everybody and thinking that I was smarter than everybody and all that. And it's just never worked out for me. And these programs have shown me that, these teachers and these directors and these psychologists and stuff that in here over the years, it always come back. I kept thinking I was smarter than all of them, but it kept coming back to the fact that nothing ever worked out for me and none of that until I started taking responsibility for my actions. I started being an adult and I started doing what I was supposed to be doing.
Okay, so thank you so much, Mr. Hampton. Thank you so very much, Honorable Mr. Neal.
Thank you, Dr. Wright. Okay, sir. I'm going to let the victims' representatives speak at this time, and then after they've had a chance to speak, we'll be back to you and allow you a final statement at that time before we go into discussion to make a determination. Okay, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm going to defer to Linda that's on the phone. Are you still there, ma'am?
Yes, I am.
Okay, would you like to say anything to the board this morning?
Oh, yes, I have a lot to say. I'm going to read a couple documents here because I write it down. Because otherwise, if I don't write it down, my class, it's never this easy. You would think I'd get used to this after 35 years doing this. And it's really hard on me. You know, I've grown older too, and I've been hurting a long time. My family has suffered a lot, and my mother went through hell. So I have a lot to say here. But first, I'm going to touch base on my brother, what type of person he was, and what kind of background he had, and what kind of family he had. And then I'll tell you what happened during that murder. Dear ladies and gentlemen of the board, I would like to take this opportunity to let you know my sins and to give you a little background into the short life of my brother Jerome Jerry Pitchy. Jerry was the oldest of four children. One year, 9 months older than myself. He was very close to age, me and my brother Jerry, so I knew him very well. Myself, 11 and 7 years older than his two brothers, my younger brothers. My mother was a single parent who looked to Jerry for assistance and guidance while raising our family. I want to share a few memories of my brother that I have. I want to give you a little insight into what kind of child Jerry was, and also to let you know how much he meant to us and how not having him around has affected our life. Jerry was a wonderful brother who used to do some crazy things with me, like dig holes like dogs and place bacon in the hole just to dig it up the next day, just to see what it looked like. I remember when Jerry was in kindergarten, I used to go, yes, he was my child. I grew up with him. He was my little sidekick. We were childhood kids. We played together. I looked up to my brother. Jerry was a wonderful brother who used to do some crazy things, like I said, with the bacon. I remember when Jerry was in kindergarten, I used to go to school across from our home and stand by the fence just to see him get out of school. Another thing that stuck out was the time that myself and a girlfriend jumped onto a motorcycle and took off while they chased us on his friend's little mini bike. We laughed and giggled at them so much I could still picture his face. While Jerry was growing up, he was a bit chunky, hyperactive, and stuttered, and had to deal at times with bullies. Yeah, and he met up bullies later in life. That's who killed him. He was a bit chunky, and bullies used to pick on him at school. And this is in grade school. There was a time I seen guys jumping on him and hitting him. I jumped into the pile and headlocked one to get them off my brother. I would protect my brother with all my might. I might have been little, but I was always there to stand up for my brother, and I wish I could have been there that day that his life was taken. So I was a bit of a tomboy, not afraid of any of the bullies. Jerry would get so mad at me for sticking up for him. He said he could handle this. He could handle his own. Eventually, through the years, his stuttering stopped and he overcome his hypertension. There were so many memories I would love to share. But we didn't have much growing up either. But my mother did her best. We ate a lot of hamburgers, beans, and potatoes, and always fried eggs before school. We always went to Sunday school also. It was always important to my mother that we learned the difference between right and wrong, good and bad, what a sin was, and to have Jesus in our heart. And Jerry asked Jesus to come into his heart the same Sunday Six, okay, Judith asked, Juliet asked Judith to come into his heart the same as me when we were young. We received identical Bibles, which I still have mine, but Kelly Hamilton and his brother threw out Jerry's in Mexico with all Jerry's other papers after they murdered and took off with Jerry's van. I would love to have that Bible. I remember when he came home from school with some pamphlets about the Navy, and if he joined, he would be able to get a college education that mom would never be able to afford. He would be able to send some money home to help her out. He was just so excited when he talked about it, because he knew it would make a positive difference in our lives. He knew what it would take to get ahead. He used to have a paper route that he worked hard at, and just so he could purchase a small little motorcycle, and he was so proud of it, so proud of himself. I remember the picture we took when he was getting ready to leave after enlisting in the Navy. He had his military papers in his hand. Jerry served overseas for 3 years on the USS Midway near Japan. He was assigned to work on the electrical items in the boiler room. My mother received many gifts from Japan, and also every time Jerry got paid, he sent money home to make sure Mom could keep up with the bills and to purchase items we really needed, like school clothes and supplies for my little brothers. In 1982, he was back in the States. He served his country during the Iran crisis and had an education under his belt. We were so proud of him. He was a man now, and he was coming home. We were so excited and proud that he was coming home. He was finally coming back with the family. He told us he had purchased the bed and the motorcycle. He loaded up that bed and hit the road to return home to us. But because of some actions of a couple people, he never made it home to be with us. That van made it home. That van, my mom seen that van got home, and it set her driveway for a whole year until she was ready to let it go, and then she had it crushed with the motorcycle in it. My mother was so excited that Jerry was finally on his way home. And so, because of the acts of a couple of individuals, there was haunt in the thoughts of what had happened to her son. She passed away in September of 2005, filled with the haunting thoughts of what had happened to her son. It was her wish that her body be cremated and be buried in the same grave as Jerry, because he meant so much to her. After Jerry's death, my mother was never the same. She began to smoke heavier, and could never seem to get it out of her mind how Jerry was murdered. She could not get it out of her mind. She sees it in her mind and left in the desert. She just could not understand how somebody could commit such a hideous crime. She began to worry about the rest of us and had a hard time trusting anyone with her children. She was always afraid of the unexpected happening again. When her middle son Michael joined the Marines, she was so afraid of losing him too. During the war, she always stayed glued to the TV to see if anything had happened in the area Michael was in. She was so proud to be a mother of the military kids, but it just broke her heart every time she heard about someone getting killed while serving their country. My mother did not talk to me about Jerry very often because it just hurt her too much. Anything that had belonged to Jerry was not to be touched. It was all she had left to remember him by or to feel his presence. By losing my brother the way he did, it helped destroy and devastate my mother, along with the rest of us. I cannot help but to have to hate these individuals responsible for my brother's death. It put my mother through a life of hell along with the rest of us. I often wonder what life would be like today if Jerry were still here, and how much better off my mother's life would have been. But we will never know. I will miss my mom terribly. She was a wonderful person that cared and loved too much. I like to think that she is embracing Jerry in her arms right now as I speak. And now, when it comes to my brother's height, he was only 5'2", so Kelly Hamilton lied again. He was no 6'2", no big guy. He was short and stocky. And now I have to read this, and then I'll be back. For the love and my respect and my brother's compassion for others, I will never stop telling the story of what took place the day he attempted to drive to his father's in North Central and then on home to his mother's in Nebraska. My brother had been discharged from the Navy in San Diego, spent 3 years overseas. A month prior to leaving, he bought a van and a motorcycle. He even owned an electric guitar. His past 3 years of his life was loaded up in that van. He left Huntington Beach around noon. I knew this because I had talked to him the night before, discussing his plan. Somewhere along the freeway in San Diego, my brother either pulled over or was approached by two hitchhikers, Kelly and Lily. My brother's van was a two-seater, so a third person would have to ride in the back. It was an enclosed panel van. When Jerry arrived in El Centro to let his hitchhikers out, Kelly and Lily pulled knives out on him. Kelly jumped Jerry from the back with his knife around Jerry's neck, really at Jerry's side. They dragged him to the back where Kelly tied his hands, really tied Jerry's feet. Kelly took over the steering wheel, while really kept watch on my brother in the back of the van. He's not telling the story totally straight. When my brother pleaded for his life, that's the talk that was going on in the back of that van. When my brother pleaded for his life to let me go, just take my van, please don't hurt me. And he really said this, and I believe my brother would say those words. Complaining, and then he also complained about the rope cable being too tight and asked if they would loosen it up, and it was hurting him. Which Kelly slammed on the brakes and yelled at Will not to touch them, that he already put the knife to his throat so there was no turning back. That's what Kelly said. Willie said Kelly just wanted to F him up, even threatened Jerry if he yelled out when he stopped at a gas station. He would kill him. Willie also said he offered pop and help out to Jerry, but Jerry didn't want it either. It may have been a 3 to 4 hour drive until, can you imagine being tied up that long, pleading for your life? Kelly drove a half mile off the road into the desert by Deer Bend, where Kelly and Willie untied my brother's feet so they could walk him away from the vehicle, making my brother believe they were going to tie him to a tree. Kelly, with the help of Willie, stabbed Jerry 7 times. 2 in the upper back, 2 in the stomach, 2 in the chest. I have the autopsy report here. I know exactly where every wound was. And the last one went through my brother's throat. Maybe my brother tried to struggle, but couldn't do too much considering his hands were tied. Wouldn't you be a bit scared for your life if you were out there in the middle of the desert? Also, he had been kicked in the head. They even kicked his body over a hill. But it was an easy kill. There were 2 of them. My brother didn't have a chance. Kelly removed the rope and my brother's watch that was on my brother's wrist and left him next to a bush. Kelly chose to wear that watch home. Kind of character would do that. Kelly also disposed of my brother's identification items, uniform, and the knife he used near Mexico. Kelly and Willie picked and choose what items to throw out or keep. Kelly and Willie drove all the way to North Carolina, where their father lived, and owned land, placed the van there as if it was a salvage vehicle. They also took my brother's personal belongings into their house. And Kelly soon turned himself in to authorities because he had left the state of North Carolina while being on parole and probation because of a past escape charge. really, then really pawned my brother's guitar in order to pay for his past court fines, then went on to Texas with a friend. Willie and Kelly were caught after my brother's body was found in a desert by college students setting the plan, and the guitar having the serial numbers on it. The guitar is what got him caught. This was a robbery, abduction, kidnapping, and premeditated first-degree murder. Premeditated by planning when and where to abduct, tie up, get rid of the evidence, which was the victim. Kelly put my brother, through so much mental and physical suffering, the extreme pain he went through, we had no idea what it would be like. To be abducted, to be abducted, tied up, confined, to lose everything right in front of your face, to be physically controlled as if you were a hostage, the mental anguish of not knowing if you're going to live or die, the excruciating pain my brother felt before he stopped breathing. I do not trust anything Kelly says, or do I believe him. He has over-exaggerated and lied to this board about everything for 35 years. He has distanced himself from this crime, so he's not able to really feel remorseful. Please take into consideration that Kelly was on probation from being paroled and one of his escape charges when he left North Carolina and then ended up murdering my brother. His past criminal felony activities involved hitting a police officer and pulling a knife, and also was charged with a vehicle homicide in which his negligence caused that person to die in the car. He has made excuses to all of these when questioned. For the past 35 years, he has lied to this parole board, mocked, and by insulting and degrading the victim's character. Yes, he degraded and he insulted my brother's character of a person. He victimized my brother all over again, these 35 years, coming in front of this parole board. It's by saying my brother wanted to go out and party with him, with two strangers out in the desert. That was one of his lies. And that my brother, they got in an argument, so my brother hit him in the face, so he stabbed him to death. He repeatedly stated he was too high on drugs to remember what had happened. Now, after 35 years, he is starting to tell the truth. This man is not remorseful. Absolutely not. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Let me tell you some of the work. Okay, thank you, ma'am. You're welcome to stay on the phone while we continue. Would you like to speak, sir?
Yes, please.
Okay.
I'm Michael Pitchy. Jerry Wood, my older brother. I was 13 when he died. Kelly and Willie made a decision back then that they were going to take the life of somebody who was just there to help them out. My brother told them that they had to stop in El Centro because he was going to go see his father. He didn't ask for any of this. He served his country. Coming back home to his family. I'm able to admit 13. But the pain that them two caused to our family hurts this day. Not only did they kill my brother, they killed my mother. And they killed a lot of us in our family. Just our memories and everything else. Willie now says, Kelly now says, that his brother was the main one in the whole thing. If anything, that makes it even worse now. They made a plea deal so that they wouldn't get the death penalty. And he allowed his brother to actually get out of prison. Kelly's got a 25 to life sentence. I can't do nothing about Willie. I was here for every single one of his paroles to keep him in prison, because they actually released him the very first time he came up. And then we found out that we weren't even notified of the parole hearing. And I was able to come back out here and speak to the parole board, and they revoked his parole. And from that day, I said I would be here every single parole, and it's every 6 months that I have to relive this. So every 6 months, we go back through the same suffering that we had 32 years ago when my brother died. I haven't been able to see him. I haven't been able to talk to him. My mother was never the same. Nobody in our family was the same after that. I joined the military later on. And every time I left, it put my mother through a lot of pain. Because she didn't want to lose another son. Luckily, I did. I came home every time. This individual, he may have remorse, but he still made a decision back then. And the decision to kill my brother, he has to live with. He should have been put with the death penalty and killed a long time ago. But he's had the luxury of being alive, 3 meals a day, hearing from his family. I can't hear from my brother. I never will. I didn't get to see him on Memorial Day because I had to come out here. So I'm always suffering. Our family is always suffering. Just because he can't see his family, that's not suffering. He can still talk to them. And I asked this parole board not grant his parole because of the heinous crime that he did commit, and his brother.
Thank you for your service, sir. Do you have anything to say?
No.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Mr. Hamilton. Are you still there?
Yes, sir.
Okay, as we are nearing the end of your hearing, the board will go into discussion in a few minutes to make a determination. But before we do that, we'd like to give you an opportunity to make a final statement. We ask that you don't repeat the information that you've already given us, but if you know, make a final statement, any other information you thought of that you'd like us to know, now would be the time.
I just wish that I had told the truth from the very beginning and that I hadn't had to put myself in a situation to where I had hurt this family the way I have. I wish they knew from the very beginning what the truth was, and maybe it would make a difference in the way they look at things and the way they feel these days. If I'd told the truth from the beginning, I can't change that now. There's nothing I can do to change anything in the past. I've worked very hard to improve myself. I'm not by no means the person I was 35, 36 years ago. If it was allowed, my counselors and everybody involved with me would tell you that, and I'm sure of it. I talk to them on a regular basis, and they, judging the person I am through these programs today and all, nobody understands that I'm not being given parole, I know I'm not being given parole because of the crime that I did and because of the lies and all that I did 35 years ago. And all I can say is I'm sorry. I'm sorry for the trouble I caused. I'm sorry for the life I took. I'm sorry for the pain I caused this family. I wish I could change it. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you, sir. The board will be going into discussion now and making determination. We talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you stay on the phone. You'll listen to the entire conversation. Just remain silent while we're in discussion. And when we make a determination, I'll get back with you and we'll discuss. Okay, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, the board is now in discussion. This is very, very unfortunate situation. Getting back to some very, very, very bad decisions made by Mr. Hamilton and his brother. But I don't know if any of those bad decisions, I think one of the worst things about it was knowing that there was three or four hour period that the victim was tied up in the back of the van and not really knowing what his fate would be. So tremendous mental anguish, which really makes it pretty heinous. But the, I have a problem with just the fact that Mr. Hamilton now, first of all, 2 years he's been telling the truth, but if that's the case, then it's going to be 3 years he didn't tell the truth. And it's a hard decision to determine whether he's really telling the truth about what happened in the office or not. I think that he is definitely remorseful that it happened, but whether it's remorseful because of the years in prison or because he's truly remorseful about having killed somebody, but I don't know. I just have a little trouble with some of Mr. Hamilton's explanations for things. I do have to commend him for the program that he's got, the cap under his belt. That is difficult in your life. He has an exemplary disciplinary record when he's been incarcerated. But it does not alleviate the seriousness of the crime. Nor does it necessarily indicate that person is truly telling the truth and truly remorseful for their actions. So I'd like to start the discussion there and see what my fellow board members might have to say about this. Mr. Canales.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. I will say, hopefully briefly, Mr. Hamilton talks about remorse and accountability, but as a matter of intuition, and I mean personal intuition, and intuition is not magic, it's a lifetime of experience and memory. Based on other cues in communication or inflection, I'm just not hearing or feeling rehabilitation or redemption. And frankly, I don't know what to believe of his story at this point. So that's my struggle. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Wright.
Well, as I stated before, this is number 7 for me, and I feel the same way as I felt when I first had the opportunity of listening to him back in 2014. We don't know what happened. Yes, he's a different person today. We all are different. But we still don't know the full story. I think that, that being said, when our determination is, would he be a productive citizen if he was released? Since we don't know the story, we cannot answer that question. Therefore, I'm not in favor, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Okay, well, based on our discussion then, and on the information, I'm going to move to deny Mr. Hamilton rental parole. One arrest or after the discharge at this time. You can wait in crime, you can't do it when you're sold off. And I will delineate the reasons after we have the voting.
Second.
Agreed.
Motion by myself, seconded by Mr. Johnson, agreed by Dr. Wright and Mr. Canones. And a reason would be serious and violent offense, loss of human life, serious and deadly offense, trauma to the victim, and serious bodily injury before the final vote. I would say victim harassment because of the amount of time that he was tied up in the back of the van, violated previous probation parole, and a history of assaulting behavior, prior criminal history. And let's see. And those would be the reasons, unless there's something that something else like that. Okay, Mr. Hamilton.
Yes, sir.
Okay, you heard the decision of the board. We have unanimously voted to deny you rental parole. Overall, you're actually discharged at this time. And did you hear the reasons that we stated?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, we do wish you luck. And hopefully that I will buy things that may change for you.
What do you want me to do? What do you mean?
Sir, we don't recommend to the offenders what we want you to do. We talk about things that we see or don't see, and we don't make recommendations as to what you should do, because the offenders may not even be on the board in 6 months, because the board is constantly changing. I think all of us would be here another 6 months, but we may not, and it's just up to you to continue on your path and try to determine what would be your best path to convince us that you can be a productive citizen.
In regards to...
Pardon me?
In regards to the crime itself and what took place and the fact that I'm trying to tell the truth now and that I've gotten past all these other stories, how can I convince the board of this? I mean, what would it take?
I can't tell you that. Okay? I mean, we don't make those kind of recommendations in the first place. I can't tell you how or what you can do or how you can do something to convince us that you... are moving in the right direction. Okay, we can't give you that kind of information. All right, so this will end the hearing, sir.
All right, okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you put the seal on the back of the phone, please?